It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio, and I'm Bonnie North. Every month, we talk with Lake Effect contributor Kyle Cherik about Milwaukee's and Wisconsin's great food traditions. Over the last year, we've covered farmers markets, new restaurants, James Beard nominations and awards that recognize Milwaukee chefs, and more. Well, last week, Cherik gave a talk at the University Club in Milwaukee, and we took the opportunity to record this month's conversation with him there. So we sat down on the sixth floor of the club, overlooking the city that Cherik is so passionate about, and I asked him a bit about his background and how he came to be the Wisconsin foodie.
You know, it found me. The story of how the show came to be a Wisconsin foodie was that the executive producer, Arthur Ersink, was a neighbor of mine. For years, we were in the same building in Walker's Point. We knew each other, but only anecdotally. And he had moved. I was simplifying my life. And he traveled with his then-girlfriend, now wife, and they sketched out what the show would be on a napkin after a great dinner, because that's how you start a show called Foodie. And he turned to her and said, I don't know who will host it. And she said, why don't you ask Kyle? And I had a big civic sort of imprint at the time, or was trying to get one. And so he got together with me, and we had a drink at Hinterland. And he pitched me, and I said, it sounds great. I don't know if I'll be any good at it. I don't know if you're any good at what you do. But long story short, we shot a pilot. We took it to the Hearst Argyle affiliate. They said, we love it. We want four of them. They put us on during ratings month, which is a blessing and a curse, because ratings month is in May. And they put us on at 11:30 on Saturdays, which, if any Midwesterner hears that, knows that that is the worst time to be doing television, especially for a new show to premiere, because only shut-ins are inside if it's sunny at all on a Saturday in May at 11:30. Yet we had great ratings, and it just sort of went from there, and eventually PBS jumped on, and then that grew us into, you know, about 8 million people if they turned on their televisions all at the same time to watch the show, which is a huge blessing. It isn't that big of an audience, maybe a million something, but it's a privilege. And we get to tell the true, honest, forthright, unsung stories of how dynamic Wisconsin is, which is not a state that does a lot of bandstanding. Yet, we provide for, as far as ingredients and talent for the rest of the country from a culinary aspect, so dynamically and so thoroughly and have for so many decades that it's almost become second nature to us.
Go back a little farther, though. You, Kyle.
Yes.
When did food kind of become the thing that you thought, I want to do something with this? Were you always interested in fine cuisine or where foods came from? Or did that evolve as you grew up?
Well, you don't think you are, but your environment sculpts you without you being aware of it. So I grew up in a Hungarian family, and my mom was an exquisite cook. And she would, about once a month, lay out these incredible fine china and that sort of thing. So that, for lack of a better term, home escoffier experience was something that I was exposed to. Her mom, my grandmother, was also an amazing cook, and I spent time in their home, somewhat raised by in early years. And then my dad's mom, who came from a Polish immigrant experience. I mean, all of the salient memories I have of all of the women in my life that raised me were doing things. And this is not uncommon, around food. I remember making sausage with my dad's mom. I remember throwing these dumplings into a steaming pot with my mom's mom, that sort of thing. And then in my own family, when my dad remarried, there were farmers on both sides. So I was cutting the heads off of chickens at the age of 9, baling hay, milking cows in a very small working family farm. That was part of the normalcy of my experience. And growing up in Waukesha, you know, Golden Guernsey just closed for a number of reasons, but because an investment banking firm just didn't find that model viable. But we would drive past this huge two-story statue of a cow. And people in my classrooms, it was not uncommon in grade school to be sharing desk space with someone whose family made a living in an agrarian capacity. So where my food came from was a given. There's the raw milk debate. We grew up drinking raw milk from my brother-in-law's farm, skimming the cream off, having it for dessert. We're all alive, you know.
And quite healthy.
A huge family. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I have all the eyelashes I'm supposed to. So without knowing that, that was part of my experience, and it definitely shaped me. So as the television show Wisconsin Foodie moved forward, these stories were more than familiar to me. They were part of me. To have the blessing of being comfortable and unawkward and at home on a farm when we would go and meet those people was something that I had always taken for granted because it was just how I had to fill my summer days. Part of what I'm in awe, though, is the alchemy of chefs. I mean, I get the farmer experience, to be honest. The thing that has really, really driven me is the commitment that chefs have to make. It's a 10-year process or 12-year to be finished, and it's a craft. It isn't easy. You don't get rich. There's very little celebrity except for a handful, even within the pantheon that we have in media now. And you have to sleep, eat, breathe, love it, or you'll wash out. So farming is the single most difficult way to make a living, right? Because you have to be a meteorologist, an economist, a day laborer, a plumber, an electrician,
a geologist,
on and on and on, all the time at any moment. A chef has got to give themselves over wholeheartedly to that craft, has to constantly make themselves uncomfortable to progress. So if you learn one style of cuisine, you'll stop being challenged by it eventually. I mean, you can dig into French or Italian or any of the great cuisines your entire life, but to really be engaged, you have to throw off everything you've just learned and start in a new path. That's profound to me.
Did you find that when you were first starting the show and you were thinking about what it was going to be and how it was going to showcase Wisconsin cuisine, were the chefs resistant to you initially, or did they welcome you in?
No, everyone welcomed us in. I think they were trying to figure out what we were, and we were. We knew to a greater extent. I mean, the show was always about where your food came from. It was shot to never look local, and it was going to be shot in a documentary or verite style, and it was not going to be personality driven. So even though I'm the host, I always say I'm the Greek chorus. I'm there to support these dynamic stories. It isn't, hey, look at me. And that's how it should be, because this state and these people and the ingredients and their stories and the terroir is really the story. But they welcomed us. I mean, I still get goosebumps, and I have to give props to Bartolotta, who got it early on. Our first season, they invited us in, and in our first couple of months, I was standing there with Jacques Pepin. years later at Kohler Food and Wine, when he was getting ready, prepping for one of his demos with his daughter, all of the chefs on the property were standing around the doorway of the tent watching what he was doing. He's a master. He's a French and American treasure. And there I was 4 months into filming, standing there talking to him. That's pretty cool.
So the chefs seem to be interested, and the farmers seem to be interested in telling stories. Do you ever find anybody in your travels around the state that really doesn't want the publicity?
Only one. The episode was going to be called Field of Dreams Pizza. There's some folks over in the Driftless region that live on a essentially sustainable farm, and they have built their own massive pizza ovens. They light them on, let's say Monday, I think, and then they bake on Wednesdays. And people drive from miles around and pull into their field, and they just make whatever they make, but they make several hundred pizzas. And the New York Times had touched on it. We reached out to do a story about them, and they said, we don't want you here. We don't want the publicity. You'll change what is special about this. We want people to hear about it organically. We don't want it to be overcrowded. Please don't come with your cameras. And we totally respected that.
Do you think that there's some of that attitude? What we were talking about earlier in the breakfast, about the seeming unwillingness of Milwaukee to blow its own horn, to actually stand out. Do you think there's a little bit of that? Like, don't ruin this. We have something special going on. We don't want everyone else to come in.
I don't think so. I think we're just bad at I think we're just bad at blowing our own horn. I don't think that we want to preserve it in amber. There isn't a restaurant in the city that I know of or a local purveyor that wouldn't be happy with more sales, more appreciation, or more butts in seats, quite frankly. Every restaurateur has got the same complaint that on the whole, Milwaukee eats between 7 and 9. And they'd love for that to change with more people that have to wait to get in. I just think there isn't a cohesion of that story being told, and we're just not used to it. We're not used to it. We get A's, we come home, we put the report card on the dining room table, and we just do our homework, because that's how you keep getting A's. We don't think, this belongs on the fridge. Hey!
Or somebody else's fridge.
Yeah, or somebody else's fridge. This belongs in the window near the street.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do we bring in the other parts of the city? We alluded to that again in the breakfast, where we have a lot of segregation. We have a lot of disparate neighborhoods, some that don't feel like they're part of the city, or they're a part of the city that we don't connect with very easily or readily. We all need to drink water. We all need to eat. How do we include those other neighborhoods?
Well, a couple things. When I do this TED-style talk in March here at the U Club as well, one of the things that I'm going to put forth is a concept of a food czar, which I'll elaborate on more, but connecting basically the safety requirements, the permitting, all of that jazz, the restaurant scene, and then the sustainability stuff that we've got going, which is dynamic, some of the water, and then just the general food systems that we have here. It's a multi-billion dollar industry in southeastern Wisconsin, what we package and prepare and process as far as things that are called food. So pulling that all together and someone that can shuttle diplomacy between all of those disparate parts. As far as the neighborhoods, to be honest, I think it's just those neighborhoods deciding to want to be part of the city. It's a little bit about what we talked about in the breakfast this morning with my fiance and I. It's a choice. You have to commit. You can say, well, this is our silo, and this is how we eat here, and this is what we do, and if more people would just come here. But you also have to say, we're a broader city. We're a patchwork quilt, but we're all connected. We do it fabulously with festivals, right? We do it wonderfully with sports teams, but we don't do it as a city entity that puts forth amazing cuisine our way. Our chefs are cooking out ahead of the rest of the country as far as what the coasts are concerned.
Elaborate on that a little bit.
So,
in what way?
So from a flyover state perspective and the way that the food media is moving, there's this big push to codify and pump up Midwestern cuisine. And the folks that are in charge of those stories and that perspective like to think that canning is becoming hot. Everybody's been doing it. I mean, people in New Hampshire have been doing it, right? We've all, as long as glass has been industrialized and we could close and seal it, whether it was just with a wax paraffin or some other great technology with a rubber seal, we've been doing it. But the ridiculousness that the national food culture has grabbed onto that as an aspect of Midwestern cuisine is a way that they will define us. Now, we've been thinking far more engagingly about aspects of cuisine like that for much longer, but we need to start defining that story for them.
How do we get them to listen? We have these great resources and we have this amazing cuisine that's ours, but how do we get it out there?
Well, I can't speak to the greater Midwest, but as far as Milwaukee, to have a point person or people or a department that reaches out to those media outlets and says, do you know this is dynamic, or coordinates. I mean, so we've had some great New York Times touches, Esquire touches, Travel and Leisure touches over the last 6 months that have talked about the cuisine. Someone from the Times came here and said, a day and a half in Milwaukee, and they ate at the Art Museum, and they essentially said, why is this so inexpensive for this caliber of great food in this great building? We don't get it. To have a little bit more of a shouting at one or two people on staff or a voice, I'm no good at administration, but that basically puts that outward. That is our own billboard.
Do you see any type of cuisine that we need to see more of here, that you'd like to see more of, that chefs aren't doing?
That's a great question. I mean, we're not as ethnically diverse as other cities, and we're not as ethnically diverse as other cities. So I'd love more ethnic cuisine. I don't know, to be honest, I don't know if Milwaukee has the populace, the dining interest to support them. And that makes me a little sad, but it's also who we are. Most restaurateurs complain about how this city eats between 7 and 9, but more and more and more places are busy after that. And there's a dining population that's developing that eats that late or thinks of going out that late. And so that's starting to change. And in that aspect, we're catching up to the rest of the country, which is good. But remember, so many restaurants have opened up in the past 2 years and then in the past six, and we talked about it on the show. There was just a need. We were underserved by options. So I remember when Hi Hat opened, and what would that be? 97, maybe, 98. And Mike Idle, one of the owners, said, you know, we're going to have a late night menu and we're really going to take on Elsa's. Well, Elsa's, Hi Hat, and Ma Fisher's were our three options. I mean, this is not exactly an exciting scene. Now, that has changed precipitously since then. Where do we go for a past 10 o'clock bite? You know, we rattle off names in the car as we're thinking about this. Oh, I don't feel like that. Oh, this would be great. I don't know. Is this person bartending there? Like, that's the good news. So that aspect has changed. But I don't know what trends per se are coming. And it's hard to say what I wish we had. I haven't thought about that. More diversity per se with ethnic dining. But then you've got to have people that will reach out and really, like, can we have a true argument in this town about the best Ethiopian? I don't think so. You know, maybe the best Thai, but that's fairly...
Or best Indian.
Or best Indian, yeah. But those are sort of American ethnic cuisines, right? So to go further, you know, I mean, can we argue about the best Catalanian cuisine between three restaurants? Probably not. And probably never here. But that's okay.
But a little taste of it,
yeah,
is good.
Would be great.
Yeah.
Would be great.
As always, Kyle, thanks for the chat, and we will catch you next month.
Right on. See ya. Let's go get a meal.
Lake Effect contributor Kyle Cherik is host and producer of the public television show Wisconsin Foodie. He also writes a regular column for Milwaukee Magazine's website. This month, we spoke to him from the sixth floor of the University Club. We'll take a quick break now, and then Wisconsin writer Michael Perry stops by to talk about his latest collection of essays. We'll catch up with him when Lake Effect returns next on Milwaukee Public Radio.